Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Leah Capitelli. Leah is an author, a blogger, artist, psychic, and more importantly, an extraterrestrial contactee. How did it all start for Leah? In the late hours of the night, when my family slept in their beds, unaware of the world around them, I found myself waking up to a strange light seeping through the window. My five-year-old mind couldn't understand why there was light during the day, nor could I understand why the shimmering light seemed to be calling me without saying my name. My only understanding was I had to go to it. So without any further ado, we'll have all of Leah Capitelli's website information, contact information on our website and our dedicated YouTube channel. So welcome to the show, Leah Capitelli.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all ours. And thank you for coming on such short notice, Leah. You know, you come highly recommended. We always want to bring people on our show to talk about ET experiences from the local grassroots perspective. You know, people on the ground, the boots on the ground that have experienced these things. Can you tell us how it began for you? You know, I read a bit in your bio about, you know, as a five-year-old. Was that your first consciously remembered experience?
My first physical experience, yes. And I would say, yeah, that was probably my very first experiences and really introduced me to ETs and, you know, life outside. And it was just, yeah, that was probably my very first experience. And ever since then, I've had ongoing experiences as well. However, my physical experiences stopped at around 6 years old, and I only had the two that I can actually consciously remember. But yeah, it was a very, very interesting early beginnings, because at that time I had no concept of ETs or anything like that, or, you know, UFO, nothing. It was just, I was an open book, really, very, very young, very naive, very innocent as well. And then it just sort of, you know, built up over the years, me realizing and talking to other people and other kids, particularly, have they had anything similar happen to them? No one did. And then it kind of dawned on me, oh, wow, okay, so this is something different, that this is something unique. And it was, yeah, it was a pretty big game changer for me since then. And yeah, now I'm basically out trying to talk to as many people who care to listen, that this is a reality. This is what's happened to me. This is what I've experienced. And, you know, if people can take it or leave it, it's up to them. That's it.
Now, tell us a bit about what you remember from that first experience when you were 5 years old.
Well, the first basically was very much so what you described before, but what you mentioned before. But when I used to be a very, very heavy sleeper when I was a kid, and something like nothing would wake me up. And then this particular night, I woke up fully awake, you know, just, it was still dark. It was still night out, you know, I knew it was nighttime, but there was a light coming from outside the window, and it was like a bluey white kind of hue to it. And it was very, very bright, and it didn't hurt to look at it. And it was like something like, oh, it wasn't the sun. It wasn't the daytime. It was none of that. And then I just had some sort of, it's like something, I can't really describe it to this day, like nothing called to me, but I knew instinctively, as if intuitively I had to go to it. So that's what I did. I get out of bed and I go around the bed and walk directly to the light. Now, I think back to that time, and what astounds me, kind of really makes me really go, wow, was I didn't stop at any point to actually, like, because there was a wall there, there was a window there, like I didn't stop at any point to stop myself from hitting into it. I just kept walking, and that's exactly what happened. I just continued walking to it and seemingly through it. And I follow along this path, this blue white path outside, and there's a woman standing on the opposite end, and she was a little bit taller than me, but I knew she was an adult woman. And I remember she was wearing a red dress, like a red robe over her skin, and she had like a very, like a yellowy golden kind of skin tone, no hair, completely bald, and big green eyes, like huge, kind of like lime green eyes. And they were just, it was just a beautiful, gorgeous appearance. And she's beckoning me to hurry up, and I go towards her, and she puts her hand on my arm or my shoulder, and she's pointing inside, and I can see like there's this room behind her, and I'm looking into this room, and it looks like a classroom, and there's human children, and there are ET children as well, but to me they, as I said, no idea what ET or human really was, the difference. I just saw there was like all these different sizes and shapes of all these kids, different skin tones, you know, different heights, different, you know, physiques, all of it. And, you know, they were human kids, but there were also adults there as well, but they were all ET. I didn't see any human adults. Human adults. And I could see they're all playing, they're all talking to each other. And what this woman said was, I want you to go to that woman sitting down on the table over there. And I turn around, and I see this woman who, she had the same height as a human, and she had purple skin, and she had purple hair, and she was wearing a very colorful, very, very colorful, bright clothes. And I remember walking over to her, and she looked very, very human-esque. Like, she had the hair, she had eyebrows, she had all, like, so it's just the only difference was she had a bit more slanted, like a little bit more elongated ears. And it was just, and I remember coming to her, sitting next to her, and I remember how she smelt like flowers. Like the more I think back on that memory, the more bits and pieces come to me. I'm like, oh my God, I remember this bit, I remember that bit. And I could feel warmth radiating from her body. And I didn't even have to touch her. I knew like she was very warm, you know, very brimming with energy. And she's like, okay, I'm going to give you some toys to play with, and I want you to play with them. And I want you to play with them as quickly as you possibly can. And after that, you can go and play with the other kids. And I said, okay. I don't really know what I said. I was like, I agreed to it. And she starts bringing out this one toy, and it looked like a, not sure the name of the shape of it, but it was like a pyramid, but it was it was even on all ends. So no matter which way you flipped it over, it was still a perfect kind of triangle, trapezium, I think.
Trapezoid,
that's it, yes. So, and what this particular toy did, you could actually pull it apart into smaller trapezoids, and you could just keep pulling it apart until they got to really tiny ones. And then you'd have to build it back up together. And then, you know, I was playing with that one for a bit. She took it away, and then she brought out another toy, and it was like this sort of like clay, like substance, gooey, kind of like you had to shake it. You had to like mold it with your hands. It was best way I can describe it was like Play-Doh. And just playing around with it and making different shapes and different, you know, little details on it. And then she took that one away, and then she brought out another one, and so on and so forth. I can't remember what the others were. Those are the only two that I can really recall. But it wasn't until many years later, when I was in my teen years, when I actually asked that same woman that purple lady, Antaji-san, she introduced herself to me as Antaji-san. I should have mentioned that before, sorry. And she was saying that all of those different types of toys represented different aspects of one's mind, one's intelligence. So it was what the trapezoid toy was represented of logic. The Play-Doh like toy was representative of creativity and imagination, and so on and so forth. So all of them had different kind of sort of like angles, and what she was doing was that she was analyzing where my brain functioned best, like where I was the most dominant in, and creativity was one of my strong points. So, you know, with the logic one, I'm still kind of, you know, fresh too, but she was just analyzing all these different pieces. And she concluded that, yeah, I'm more adapt to this particular, to creativity. And since then, she's been giving me information relevant to that particular, subject or whatever it is. So like, you know, talking about history, talking about culture, talking about, you know, a variety of different things. So yeah. And sorry, I can go on for ages about this.
It's quite all right. And I can vouch for Leah's creativity because she is an outstanding artist. I commissioned her to do a couple of full color drawings for me, and she did. She did a bang up job. Thank you, Leah. It's short notice too.
Thank you.
So, you know, also, on Leah's website, one thing I've noticed about many people like ourselves that have contacts, the common media depiction of people like us is that we're dolts, is that we're fantasy prone individuals, and that we make things up. But actually, the truth is quite different. So many of us are very creative, and art is one of the things that you've become very good at. How old were you when you found out? Was it around the time or shortly after you had this experience you just described?
I could draw. I remember, like, I could draw ever since I was 2 years old. I remember my, you know, grandmother teaching me how to hold a pen, and ever since then, she never taught me how to draw. I just, you know, she just taught me how to hold a pen, and that was it. But ever since I was very, very young, ever since I touched pen to paper, I could do it. I don't know where that came from. I guess I always had it in me. It was just an ability or skill that I discovered, fortunately, very, very early in my life. And I just, you know, I tried to home in on it and develop it a bit more. And I had support from my family here on earth and my friends and family upstairs. So yeah, it was a really good, it was very good for me. And I had that support. And without that, I don't think I would be the person I am today. Certainly not. And I home in a lot of, like, I remember actually drawing these beings as well at a very early age, but I wasn't, again, I just didn't, I only ever drew what I saw or what I heard or whatever I felt, you know. It was just something that I had to pick up from somewhere else, because I just didn't have the ability to conjure something like that up.
And yeah, you didn't have a conceptual framework.
Exactly. And I remember even my school teacher saying, oh, wow, those are really nice. You know, like, they're commenting on my drawings. They're like, oh, wow, these are really, that's really creative, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, thank you. But, you know, at being so young, I just took it as a compliment on my skill, not my actual ability to conjure something like that up.
Did you ever have, like a lot of us have, very vivid dreams, ET UFO related dreams, or waking visions? You know, sometimes the two run parallel, because we go through phases. I know for me, I'm one of those guys that it happens to me psychically. I can go for periods without any kind of experience, dream, telepathic, physical, or whatnot. And then suddenly, you know, they start happening again. For me, a lot of my experiences were in the dreamscape, the astral dreamscape, or mystical visions. Did you ever have a lot of, you know, those types of dreams where you were encountering beings or intelligences or angelic figures?
Absolutely, absolutely. Even at that age, like, I mean, nearly all of my experiences with ETs is through these astral means. It's you know, I actually visit them, they actually visit me. Physical contact, as I said, doesn't happen nowhere near as often at all. And I feel like that's usually their go-to, because it physically manifesting to us does pose a danger to them. So if somebody they want to contact is sensitive to those energies and sensitive to that, to their presence, well, it just makes common sense to be able to manifest to them in that, you know, state. So, I remember even being a child, I could actually contact them and them contact me. And I remember interacting with ET, like, you know, ET children while in an astral state as well. And they knew me and I knew them, and, you know, but again, I had no framework for this. I thought this is what you experience when you go to sleep. You know, this is completely normal. But, you know, and I even made friends for a while. And, Yeah, but that was very interesting. And it wasn't until, as I said, like as I got older, when I was taught, like, hey, hang on a minute, this is what that really was. That wasn't, you know, this, there's a difference between, you know, waking state and astral state, and, you know, what you were experiencing then was astral, and so on and so forth. And, you know, it really opened my eyes to a whole different perspective on the universe, that there's so much more that is going on than just the corporeal, what we perceive to be the corporeal realm or plane. And not just that there's an astral plane as well, but that there are beings interacting with it and interacting with the astral plane, and beings from the astral plane interacting here with us. So it's a duality, and it's just like, oh wow, it really blows everything. We only experience a small portion of it, but it's just, wow. I can go on forever about it.
Yeah. And what's interesting too, Leah, is I don't know what it was like in your case, but when I was younger, people were, you know, kids were more open to that, because the conditional societal brainwashing really hadn't set in yet, so we can talk about these things. And so, kind of like yourself and probably other people, I began asking my young friends if they'd ever had experiences like this, if they'd ever seen the kind of things that I'd experienced. And although just about everyone said, no, that didn't happen to me, I'm kind of glad it didn't happen to me, I wasn't met with a wall of disbelief or ridicule. That only came later, right? Because they were still kind of in that golden age too, because we were like year two, year three, and you know, before the walls come down and stuff, we could still talk about these things.
Sure.
Now, I've gone through the star school scenario too, and it's very interesting, because that can, you know, carry on clear into adulthood, and sometimes one finds themselves being the instructors. Did you ever find yourself teaching kids, and human kids or ET kids or?
Not personally, no. I don't ever recall being the instructor when I'm in my astral state or, you know, I do have many occasions have actually visited other ETs while they were in their physical, like corporeal forms, like what we have now. And they interact with me and I interact with them. And sometimes they're not too pleased to see me wandering around their home. They're like, what are you doing here? You're a stranger, get out, you know? But no, I've never been in that scenario. Well, maybe I might in the future. I don't know. But well, according to my guides, I'm not exactly that mature to actually handle something like that as of yet. And I'll be honest, I tend to get carried away sometimes.
Look, there's nothing wrong with enthusiasm and being excited about one's you know, place in the overall scheme of things. Did you ever have like mystical visions or waking visions or dreams about being in an otherworldly setting or scenario? Did you ever have like a dream of being on another world, another star system?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I was just astrally visiting a world two nights ago, and I was interacting with the world there. And I remember being at a place where there were ruins of a temple, of a very old ancient temple, and it was partially submerged underwater. And I remember seeing young people and children jumping into that crystal clear water, and, you know, jumping around and playing in the water. And I remember there was like, you know, reeds and grass and trees growing along the around the rim. And it was just such a beautiful, pristine, such a light scene. And I remember just, you know, like getting emotional, and not in a sad, partially sad, yes, because I couldn't physically be there with them to enjoy what they were experiencing, but I got snippets of it. And so it's kind of, to be perfectly honest with you, it's kind of bittersweet. You know, I can actually travel. I'm still not, you know, I still don't have full control over it, but sometimes it is very bittersweet, because like, oh, you know, you get to see all these different places, go anywhere you want, you know, you can interact with whomever you desire, you know, that can obviously perceive you. But sometimes those places where you really want to be, you you can't experience it with your physical body. And you kind of go back and you're like, oh, my physical body is lying in my bed right now. You know, so it's just, but look, I look at it in a positive way. You have to, otherwise you'll just, you'll start crying and you'll never stop crying basically. Yeah. So yeah, no, it's great. Like, I feel like, you know, I have this opportunity to really, really look at how these other worlds and how these other beings live and interact with each other and interact with their world and interact with me as well. And it's just, and it's eye opening and it's intriguing. And it's just, it's so, this is what makes life worth living. It really does. Like, even when this place here on earth can get really, really, can really bear down on you sometimes, that's kind of like my short-term retreat, very, very short-term retreat. And it kind of, you know, revitalizes me and I'm like, yeah, all right, I can face another day on earth tomorrow. Let's do it, you know? So yeah, that's the way I look at it.
What happens sometimes is that these higher dimensional ETs, you know, to descend into our density, you know, of our planet, it's difficult for them, and it's dangerous too. If they have to densify their ship into our atmosphere, it can be shot down by the military or for sure. You know, or something. So they have to take all these necessary precautions. So for those that have, the contactees here on the surface that have that higher dimensional capability within their DNA, it's much easier and safer for them to take us where they're at instead of coming down here and having to, you know, deal with all these, you know, possible pitfalls.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier, Leah, that they taught you a variety or showed you a variety of subjects. Like, did they show you anything in our Earth's past about, say, like celestially driven cataclysms or like Atlantis or Lemuria or things like that, which we've heard of?
Yes. Well, fortunately, as I was getting older, when I was exiting my childhood, I started to remember my life in Atlantis. Now, I only remember up until the point of my death. So I can't tell you, like, because I wasn't alive anymore, I can't tell you the aftermath of what happened. But my contacts, they actually gave me information of the aftermath of that cataclysm, of the sundering of Atlantia. And they were showing me, it was interesting because they don't really tell me through words, they show me through images. And I can process that far better than just simple like words, here you go, bam bam. So they were showing me images of people, the survivors leaving, getting out, and when they finally left the ruined land, you know, they are desperately seeking out a new place to call home. And a lot of other places around the world that were civilized had their own sort of civilization and culture in place, but the Atlanteans, these ones, they wanted to have their own. They wanted to have Atlantia too, you know. They wanted a second chance. But a lot of other people were like, no, you made your bed, you got to sleep in it. Now this is our land, this is our territory. You can't just come in here thinking that you can just take a, well, yeah, wars happened, and they were showing me a lot, like these wars that were going on for decades, you know, destroying what was left of other advanced civilizations, and it left everyone in ruin, and everyone basically going back into something, you know, basically going back to the trees, you know. Yeah. There's nothing left, like basically a complete de-evolution, back down, you know, back to primitive, you know, sticks and bows. That's it. That's all there was. And yeah, now it's a steady climb back up again. Yeah. They were showing me the aftermath. So that's, you know, and lots of other bits and pieces as well, but yeah, wow. It's heartbreaking because it's like, how many times does this need to happen, you know? Like, really, how many? I don't know.
And that's the problem with this collective amnesia. Yeah. A lot of us that have gone through these cataclysms when we've had lives in these advanced civilizations that essentially destroyed themselves, right? Mm. Or due to some celestially driven cataclysm, you know, the surface world was pretty much rent asunder. The psychological trauma of that is embedded in our DNA. So, and this is why people don't even want to hear the subject of celestially driven cataclysms, because, you know, a lot of them have the trauma unresolved from those past lives. Now, when they showed you the images of these major wars that happened after Atlantis was destroyed, did they show like weapons of mass destruction, beam weapons, nuclear weapons, that kind of thing?
They didn't show me the details of the kind of weapons that were used, but they were, I do recall particle beams being used, like something equivalent to lasers, and just puncturing holes in the ground. And it was just, you know, like where once was a small village is now just a crater kind of thing. So it was...
Yeah, that's traumatizing. They have to see stuff like that, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, and it's even... Because, I mean, going back, you know, because I do remember being an Atlantean, and we weren't a warlike people. Well, not that from my old memory, we weren't warlike. Well, not in the time when I was around anyway. And we didn't destroy. We tried to keep everything as peaceful as possible. And then all of a sudden, you know, the survivors just went bloody crazy, wanting their own territory again, and just started bloody, you know, shooting and destroying other places that they have helped nurture and grow. It's just like, are you mentally ill?
That's interesting, because, you know, in our human history, we see similar patterns, because really in ancient time, well, to us ancient times,
not to us ancient, to
the archaeologists is ancient, but us it's like yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but if you look at like the wars between Sparta and Athens warred against many of its colonies. Wait a minute, we're the ones that sent you over there 100, 200 years ago, whatever. You work for us, you know. And by that time, they kind of developed their own identity. They had their own trading arrangements with other peoples. It's like they didn't want Athens anymore, and Athens had to go and do bully boy stuff on them. Did the ETs, did they give you an idea of what their cosmology is like? It's like, you know, was there a consortium or a federation or a grouping of them? Did they warn about any other kind of negative ETs that may show up every once in a while and cause problems? Also, within the context of showing you the Earth's, you know, history, did they talk about these things?
Not that often. Okay, so... Because this is, yeah, this it's a great question, and there's a lot of answers to it. Because
yeah, take your time.
Okay. So according to my contact, according to Mesrith and Antaji-san, but particularly Mesrith, he's the energy being that I came into contact with when I was, you know, in my teen years, and basically reawoke me back into this world, really. Okay, so he was telling me that after the fall of Atlantia and the wars, when his people came back to have a look at what happened, because apparently Earth was not the only place affected around that time as well. So there were other worlds with other beings that, you know, physical, like young beings, like, you know, young races like us, that were also experiencing their own strife as well. And when they came back, they were like, oh boy, this is bad news. What are we going to do here now?
Leave you alone for a little while, and this is what happens, right?
Yeah,
go ahead, please.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you take the training wheels off and they completely crash and burn. It's like, what? I don't know how this happened. So, they basically were like, right, okay, this is not permissible, because they're going to end up destroying everything. So, what they've done was that they basically turned off our ability to recall partially because we individually ourselves, sometimes it's so traumatizing, as you said before, we don't want to remember our history, our past lives. But they also actually implemented that themselves. They're like, right, we can't do this. We've got to turn this off, because this is they're going to end up consuming this whole world. We can't let this happen. So basically they turned a few evolutionary levels down, just so we can start back down from start from a lower base and then slowly build up again to something a little bit better, because we were on our way out. Like, we were on our way to extinction plus everything else, plus the biosphere. Not too dissimilar to what's happening now, but it was more, there was more of an emergency back then. There was more of an urgency, sorry, back then. So they had to dial it back down a bit and then really, really put the effort and time into guiding us in a proper way. Now, of course, mistakes happened along the way. You know, there was interference with others outside as well, some extra dimensional entities, some self-serving groups that sort they like, hey, this is a fairly primitive world. Hey, you know, we can see, let's see what we can get out of it. You know, like, let's, you know, they're defend, they won't know who we are. They don't know, because they don't know who we are or what we are. We can, you know, we can do whatever we want. Because they don't know what we are, they're defenseless against us. So, whoop, here we go. Whereas Mesuth and his people, they were desperately trying to like slap them away. It's a back and forth thing, and it's been going on for who knows how long. And they're still desperately trying to get us back on track. And you know, according to Mesuth, he says this is the best alternative outcome for this world at the moment. Again, he still hasn't told me what the other alternatives could be, but he thinks that, you know, out of all the things that could have happened in our history, this is probably one of the best ones. This is the best path that we could have taken. So it almost implying that there is that we will get to a better future sooner rather than later. So, it's because there's so much going on, like, because 15, you know, for me, like, I remember Atlantia, getting destroyed 15,000 years ago, and a lot can happen in 15,000 years. So I'm not privy to everything that happened, but what's actually interesting, as well. And, some of the Atlanteans that weren't involved with the war, some of the survivors, the Atlantean survivors who were not involved with the wars, I should also mention, they were desperately trying to ensure that future civilizations would remember what happened. So what they were doing is that they pulled in all their resources, pulled in everything they possibly can to actually ensure that their memories will be preserved and ensure that their records and their mistakes, more importantly, were remembered. So, you know, going into like they, you know, going to different places around the world and creating vaults, storing their pieces of not just technology, but also their equivalent to crystal hard drives. I mean, even the crystal skulls were used to store that information that was even made before the fall of Atlantia as well, that was being used. So they were desperately trying to do everything they can to create some sort of legacy, because they knew they were dying. They knew they were on their, like, this is it. Like, we can't continue anymore. Let's just, like, even though we may be dead, at least our memory still lives. And we kind of remember, but we'll get there one day. And the thing is, what's interesting, like, if you look at some of the more ancient histories, ancient cultures on Earth now, they still talk about Atlantia. Maybe not use the word Atlantia or Atlantis or anything like that, but they talk about an ancient civilization that a white city or a silver city, or all these words that describing basically the same thing. And they're talking about something horrible happening to the city, something tragic happening to the city, something terrible happening to the people and to the land. It's repeating throughout different cultures. So they kind of succeeded in that way, but yeah, I think it's interesting. So yeah, we just have to uncover more, because I know there's more information about Atlantia, even some bits and pieces left to uncover, because there's no way a civilization that big and that powerful didn't leave anything behind. There's no way. Like, they did take precautions. They did take, they did put in the effort to ensure that, okay, our legacy survives. So
Yeah, and especially the legacy in the form of people like you that would have future incarnations that would, you know, remember at least part of this.
Mm-hmm.
They imply that those with perhaps the Atlantean imprint in their genetic profile, morphic resonance field, that those people in particular, sometime down the track, were they to stumble upon, quote unquote, some of this, you know, like crystalline technology holding memory, holding information, that they kind of imply that that may be in the offing for certain people.
Like, as in like they taking the precautions to.
So it only activates for certain people that have a profile, and that some people definitely will have access to it at some point in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, I'd be floored to think that there's no human living in this world today that doesn't have at least a little bit of Atlantean DNA. I don't believe it. I'm sorry. Like, for example, like there's the Basque civilization that was living in Western Europe once upon a time. Some of them were the survivors, the originals, you know, that were Atlanteans. So they just obviously spread around and, you know, made friendly with other cultures. And they're like, hey, you know, here's a byproduct several thousand years later. I do believe that there's some of it, like, because it's interesting, because I feel that some of that technology that they have left behind would resonate with people who are attuned, maybe not necessarily genetically in tuned, but in tuned on a more soul based level. Like, for me, because I have such a strong memory of my past life, maybe something might open up for me when I come across an Atlantean artifact, for example.
Yes.
I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is what it is. And I just have it, like, I feel like I would know what to do with it. Even though I may not actively remember ever using that particular piece, for example, I'd just be like, wow, I know what I need to do with this, and I know how to use it. So it's just, yeah, like, for sure, absolutely. Anything's possible, really.
Well, I've always felt that there had to be more than just the so-called Hall of Records beneath whatever paw of the Sphinx. And they've got that sewn up anyway, right?
Mm.
And so, like, you know, as far as the Egyptian antiquities and whoever's controlling them is concerned, I mean, one way to find out about that is through remote viewing or something like that, to find out what's beneath it, short of having ground penetrating radar, which we don't have. Right? So now, also from you know, you're recounting these memories of Atlantis and what you were told, it implies that, and something that some of us have felt, that there was a time when the gods, i.e. the ETs, walked amongst the humans. And I take it Atlantis was one of those situations where it was just quite common to pass people on the street that weren't quite human.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at Atlantia, like, we had ETs living on Earth that, like, actually took up residence, and actually some of them were born on Earth, and vice versa. Some humans not, you know, going to other worlds and, you know, living their lives, taking residence there and having children there as well. So it was no different than to travel. You know, back then it was no different to travel internationally or interstellar. Like, it was something that you just did. Like, oh, I'm moving to Mars. Oh, okay, I'll see you next week. You know, like, you know, it was just so normal. Like,
us taking a flight to Paris or something. And
yeah, you know, exactly.
Different cultures in Paris. Yeah,
exactly. It was just so normal. Like, I mean, yeah, you walk around the city here and you're like, oh, you meet someone from you know, Denmark or America. Well, back then you were like, oh, I'm from Elzona. Oh yeah, that's cool. I can, you know, it's just like, oh, I'm from Zan. Oh wow. Nice to meet you. It's just all these different worlds. It doesn't matter. Like, the thing is, no one considered it strange at any point. Well, not around my time anyway, because it was so normalized and it was so accepted. It was just like, oh, you know, like I remember one of my, well, my managers, you could say, for when I was working back then, he was from another world. He was an ET. You know, he wasn't born on Earth, but he came from another world and has been living on Earth for who knows how long. And yeah, he wasn't very nice with me, but that's okay. You know,
sometimes bad bosses.
Exactly, exactly. Some of them. Yeah, like, you know, some people you can click really well with. Some people you can't. And you know, unfortunately, he was just one of those that I couldn't really click with. But yeah, again, it didn't affect my life in any way. Well, it enriched my life in many ways, because I had the option to go to any world and experience any culture. And the sad thing about it is that I didn't realize the advantage at that time, because I could physically go anywhere and experience and talk to any being coming from whichever corner of the galaxy. It's like, thinking about it now, like, oh my God, I can't really do that now, you know? And it's just, yeah, you don't know what you have until you lose it, basically, yeah. is my thing. And it was just a very normal way of living. And people as well were very different, as you know, because it was such a diverse population, both internationally and interstellarly as well. It was just, people were so much more friendlier. People were, had lighter spirits as well. Like, people were more susceptible to kindness, and more people wanted to help without actually.
Was telepathy more common back then?
Yes, as well. Well, that's actually another thing. Yeah, you couldn't exactly, you know, lie to someone, bullshit
yeah,
yourself
right through you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it did. Yeah, you could try, but you know, good luck, basically. But yeah, like, people couldn't. Honesty was if you, people would always find out the truth. And, you know, if you were honest about something and you were upfront, you would have far more respect than you would to someone who's like obviously being dishonest, because it was going to come out anyway. There's no way you can hide it. And yeah, like, that's it. And it was looked down upon, lying. So you might as well tell the truth. And not to mention, when it comes to the telepathy aspect of things, when we encountered other beings who were not who couldn't speak the language of the civilization there, we would use telepathic and translators to actually help, you know, to translate what they're trying to communicate. And so that was also another thing. Like, it was basically a universal translator as well, like, on top of. So if you were proficient in telepathy and you talk to somebody else who were sensitive to telepathy, maybe not necessarily telepathic themselves, but who couldn't speak the language, you could just talk to each other through each other's mind and, like, know exactly where you both are, where you both stand, what you're trying to say to each other as well. So that's just another aspect of things, which is like, which we unfortunately don't really have nowadays. But yeah, as I said, it was a completely different world. Like, it was Earth, but it might as well be another planet, you know? It was
Definitely. Definitely. Like, that's the funny thing about it, Leah, is like, people look around today and they see the trappings of modern civilization with people glued to their, you know, digital phones and everything else. But it's so far from being truly modern. I mean, these megalithic sites have withstood earthquakes, withstood everything, and stood the test of time, and they're still there. Meanwhile, you know, all these steel structures are rusting and, you know, coming apart at the seams.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Atlantean times, you mentioned a moment ago that you had a boss in, you know, one particular period of your time there. Was there like a division of labor there amongst the people? And, you know, what kind of, did people go through an apprenticeship? Did they go through, you know, schooling? Because in one of my Egyptian lives, I was a scribe, and I spent a lot of time just being a scribe and being taught, you know.
I was a scribe in Atlantia.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Okay. This is getting more interesting now. That we did have an education system. I do recall, like, I only ever remember being called and referred to as the academy, and it was kind of like a education system where you didn't just have elementary or middle school, high school and tertiary. It was all kind of like squashed into one. It wasn't, you had levels, but it wasn't broken up in that way. So you could stay in the academy, for example, from whatever young age, like 5 years old, for example, and stay there until you're 25.
Yes. I spent a lot of time in one of my Egyptian lives, like decades, just being trained as a scribe, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, it was interesting because, I do recall we didn't have classes in a sense of like, you know, big group of people and one instructor. It was one instructor per student. And we did a lot of our education, not when it comes to the more complex, like the more, I guess you could say, equivalent to tertiary education, like, for example, being a scribe, that required actually being a little bit more, how do you describe it? Like being inside, being in a class and actually doing the work. But in our younger years, being a child, the instructor and student would go outside and talk to each other, you know, and the instructor would say like, look at that plant over there. And then they would describe the plant and like the functions of a plant, like, you know, the xylem and phloem, the photosynthesis, all of it, you know, and just talk about just teach children in that manner. So it really opens up the world to them, not just sitting in one box and, you know, behind a desk and just, you know, like just having all these words and come, you know, all these words thrown at them and they're like, I don't know what to make of it. It was a back and forth sort of teaching system, and it was very, very flexible. And as I said, one teacher, one student. So it was, you know, so the teacher would get a really good impression on how the student learned and what they were, where the skills lay, where the strengths and weaknesses were. And it was also, their functionality was also something similar to a counselor as well. So if the kid was having a bad time in the rest of the school or having a bad time at home, they could talk to the teacher, no problem. There was no, like, you know, there was like a mentor. It was more like a mentorship, if anything. So, and you had that however long you needed it, and no one scorned anybody for having a mentor at the age of 25. Like, I mean, everybody did. I mean, a lot of people did. So, I mean, I certainly did. And yeah, but it was it didn't feel like an education, if you know what I mean. Like, it didn't feel like a center of education. It felt like you are going somewhere and you're going to learn about something new. And they exposed you to as many different things as possible so you can get a better impression on how something worked. Like, if you wanted to learn about mathematics, we'll go to a center that's dedicated to physics. Like, it was like field trips all the time. It was field trips everywhere all the time. And it's just a very different life back then. So it was amazing.
When the ETs were showing you different things, did they ever teach you, and I've heard this from other contactees, I wanted to run it by you if it sounds familiar, where they would show you like advanced physics or hyperdimensional physics, or show you all these equations which consciously may not make any sense to you, but at some soul level, kind of maybe it's set to go off and you figure it out later on or something, you know?
That's a good question, because I was never my mind couldn't they tried. I remember in the earlier years they tried giving me some information based around giving me mathematical equations to for certain things, and I just never really took it very well. Like,
I'm not a math person either, so
good. Woo! Okay, not the only one now. It's good. But it was they did attempt to actually transfer information, and my brain just couldn't accept it. Like, it just came out as jarble. Like, it gave me a really bad headache. I could tell you that. But what's interesting, so instead of actually giving me the hard numbers to describe certain things and to describe physics, they were showing me. They were telling me about it in like as if they were telling a story. Like, It wasn't until my later years, and even today, that I'm still learning about physics as well. But they're talking to me and they're like, oh, so the astral realm, and then you have astral line energy, and you've got, this is how the two interact, this is how you have the corporeal plane, and then you've got the astral plane, and this is how they interact in this universe, and energy passes through here and there and so on, back and forth. They're constantly, so they're telling me all these things, but they can't actually show me through equations because I just don't have the capacity to really absorb it. So what they've done was the thing is, I'm really pushing to learn and understand how they understand physics and what they have uncovered. And it's not easy, but I'm getting there, you know, bit by bit. And they're talking to me about different, you know, particles and how they react with other, you know, it's just incredible. Like, you have some particles that we haven't even discovered yet, and they already know about them. They've already discovered them, and some of them, like some energy residue coming from other realms, pass through and fall into what we perceive to be the corporeal plane. And what they can be used for, and how they're used, and what they do, and what their function is. And it's just, and I'm learning all about these sort of things, and it's like, oh my God, this is incredible. Like, possibilities are endless, you know. And this is, and they're teaching, they were teaching me about how they harness energy using those esoteric energies. So this is how they actually pull from the universe and actually transmute that energy, and they can switch it around into something else, like into electrons or photons or whatever it is. And then they can make light with it. They can make heat with it. They can make, do anything. And it's just, yeah, really, really advanced stuff. So I'm still learning about it myself. So yeah, I still don't know the full thing, but once I do, I'll definitely be writing about it.
You know, because it's a hyperdimensional physics, and it's what you described, their ability to pull energy from other dimensions and other realms and then transmute it and make it usable to them. But it doesn't require burning anything up. It doesn't require combustion or destroying anything or wiping out the environment to do it. So that's yet another reason for the cover up, because these things, they fly around and are not powered by, you know, petroleum or anything like that.
Yeah.
The ETs that you're interacting with, do they give you an idea of like a place of origin, like where they're from, if they're a higher dimensional race, and whereabouts in the cosmos in a higher dimension are they from? Did they ever tell you something like that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I love learning about their species history and their history of their worlds. The ones I'm the most acquainted with, I'm acquainted with about 12 different races or species altogether. I know there are some others outside, but I don't know them as well. But the ones that I do know about, like, I try and learn everything I possibly can. It's just some of them, actually, with the exception, where do I even begin with with the ones that I've learned so far? Mesreth and his people, like, they call themselves, so the names that I refer to these races is the names that they have told me that they refer to themselves. So I just spell it out how I perceive it, how I hear it, if you will. And
Phonetic,
that's the one I was,
you can get. Yeah,
exactly, because they don't have an English spelling of it, so I just do my best. Like, it's, this sounds about right. Anyway, so the Nevensaurus, which is the name of Mesreth's people, one of my contacts, they are beings of energy, and they evolved to that point several hundred million years ago. I don't know when. And they have been around for at least a couple of billion years. I wouldn't be surprised if not longer. So they were the ones responsible for creating, seeding, if you will, different worlds. including us, including Earth as well. So there are other races like that, but they are a bit of an enigma because they don't really, because of their vast history and their complicated backgrounds and history and culture, he doesn't really tell me that much detail. Like, he only tells me what he thinks I need to know, or whatever he thinks I should know. And that's about it. And like, they, because they were once upon a time physical beings as well, and they apparently, their home star, their home star, the home world, is in the Pleiades star system. And I've only been there once, to their home world once, when I was in my astral form, and he took me there because I actually tried to get Mesereth to take me to their world several times, and he always said, no, you can't go. I'm like, why? It doesn't make any sense. And so one day he eventually, if you will, snuck me in, and he was showing me somewhere in their kind of, if you, some countryside area. And it was I'll tell you what, James, I've been to other worlds. I've seen other worlds. I've seen their nature. I have never seen anything like this. This is literally as if, this was so alien to me. I can tell you right now, like, the trees, they did have something equivalent to trees, but they weren't solid. Like, they didn't have the trunks. You could see an outline, or at least a discoloration of the background of a trunk, but on the inside you can see the branches, you can see the roots from underneath the ground. And inside that, you could see they were kind of like a light, like a neon pink light through the center, like as if there were veins growing inside the trunk and inside the branches and inside the roots. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, what the hell is this? You know. And what was even more amazing, I'm just watching these trees like sort of like shimmer and then vanish. And then they would appear again, and then they would vanish again. I'm like, they're phasing. I asked him, like, what is this? What's going on here? I didn't know what they were. And he's like, oh, they're trees. And I said, what are they doing? And they're like, oh, they're just phasing in another plane at the moment. I'm like, oh, okay. okay. Fine. And I remember looking up at the sky as well. Like, I remember tilting my head back, and I can see the atmosphere. And I can see what I assumed was a celestial, what was it? Was it the sun? I think it might've been the sun, actually. I'm not sure. See, this is how distorted everything looked, because it was something it was so bizarre. I had no way of comprehending everything.
You had to kind of filter it through your own understanding and framework in a way that made sense to you.
Exactly. And it was, cause I'm looking at this, what I assume is the sun and the moon. Okay, so I remember there was a sun and the moon, and I remember light passing through the atmosphere and hitting us, the surface, and on the surface. But everywhere you walked, now this is what's interesting. Oh, where you walk, where you ended up, the light would change color. So, like, for example, the light that's reflecting off the surface had like a greenish kind of hue. And if you continued strolling along to a different area, then the light would become a different color, like a blue or a yellow or a red. And it was constantly changing, as if it was like, this is the best way I can describe it. You know, when the sun passes through stained glass windows of like a church, and you have like
the prismatic effect.
Prismatic. Yes, exactly. It was prismatic. And it was just, and I'm like looking at this thing, and why is it doing this? And apparently this world is so old, and this world has seen and been through so much that the world itself is phasing between planes and dimensions, and giving the impression that it's all like, you know, all these different energies are coming through and passing through and going out. And it's just, that's why it looks so prismatic and colorful.
Did he mean to imply that his world was in a state of transition, maybe like transcending into a higher plane or something like that?
He never specifically stated that, but he's dropped that hint several times throughout our relationship. So he's his world is obviously very much so, that his whole biosphere is very highly evolved. And it's almost as if like it's, I think that might be actually, come to think of it, I think that's why his people are so hesitant on inviting younger species on that world, because it's so unstable. And we'll go with unstable.
Yeah, in a state of flux, basically.
Yes, flux, exactly. I mean, who knows? It could be phasing through time itself. I don't know. I have no idea where it is. I don't know where it's going. I don't know what it's all about. But all I can tell you right now, it's something weird is going on in that world, and along with his people. So that's just something that's something for a later time to discover. Yeah. But
he didn't imply that, you know, maybe his time with you would end and someone else would come and take the place, because they're going to move on, or, you know, did he give any indication of that?
Actually, interesting you mentioned that, because that's something I haven't thought about in years. He has implied it once, and we have spoken several thousand times over the last decade, right? And he's mentioned, he's sort of touched upon it once, and he says, will you, it's hard to explain, but it's, this is the impression I got from him. He said, will you be okay without me? And I'm like, well, eventually.
Yeah.
or something like that. Because this is when I was really like interested and keen to learn about his people. That's when he started to ask the questions of, will you be okay without me? He wasn't really talking to me in that sense. It was interesting, because it was almost as if he was asking the universe itself.
Out loud about, was, you know, the possibility of what would it be like.
He says, will you be all right on your own? Will you miss us, or something like that? Or will you miss me? It was very strange. And it wasn't like, he wasn't asking me these questions. He was just kind of like, yeah, as you said, thinking out loud. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? Like, where are you going? And he says, nowhere. I said, oh, then why are you talking about it? He says, don't worry about it. Well, thanks for making me worry about it. And
about it, you know, is, and the beauty of it is, Leah, is, what'll happen eventually is, within your morphic resonance field, within your DNA profile, your energy field, no matter where he goes and, you know, continue his journey, his people's journey, in whatever higher plane of existence, there'll always be that connection to you. It's just like how our loved ones go into the afterlife, and when they need to get a message to us, they will. You know, and even our beloved, you know, four-legged family members, when they pass over, you know, they let us know they're in a good place, you know. Yeah. So, you know, I'm getting chills thinking about it, because what happens to us in our physical embodiment, we forget that, you know, we have this connection, you know, that spans time and space and all these different dimensions and realms, and we are emotional beings, and it's easy for us to miss. We form attachments with people, you know, of all stripes, you know, and you just describing this, you know, what amounts to a relationship with, you know, this highly evolved being. Well, we've reached the end of the fascinating first segment. We've got a whole hour to go. Leah, please tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you and what your website is.
Yeah, so you can reach me on my Facebook. It's Leah Capitelli. You can hit me up anytime. I will respond to you as soon as possible. I'm also on Instagram as well. So yeah, come and follow me on there. My website is Starseed Leah at, I'm just trying to remember the name of the website.
Oh, I've got it. I can pull it up. It's
thank you. Yeah, so it's
starseedleah.wixsite, WIXSITE. .com. So all together, starseedleah.wixsite.com. And we will be sure to put the links to Leah's website on our dedicated website and our YouTube channel. So we've reached the end of the first half. To our dear listeners, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up, and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.